So,
aliens, right? So interesting. We have a pretty full house in here, and I just glanced online. There's 131 devices logged into Zoom. If you have more than what, there's probably 180 something, 200 or more people watching online as well. So people are apparently interested. So let's talk about it. So this summer, when I was planning my sermon topics for the year, I stumbled upon a social media post from Matthew Bowman, who's a professor of religion and history at Claremont Graduate University. He was promoting his new book, The Abduction of Betty and Barney Hill, Alien Encounters, Civil Rights, and the New Age in America. It's significant to highlight that this book is published by the prestigious Yale University Press. This instant is the first among many examples we're going to consider that whatever is happening around aliens or UFOs or UAPs is increasingly being taken seriously at the highest levels. The part of Bowman's social media post that really got my attention said this: "Come for the crop circles, stay for the Unitarians." Now, clearly, I had to read this book. And now, exactly. And then now here we all are this morning. So how many of you previously sort of knew the story of Betty and Barney Hill? Okay, a fair amount of you. For the uninitiated, I'll give you a brief introduction. On September 19th, 1961, they were driving late at night on a remote road in New Hampshire when they saw a flying saucer. Their story is interesting for a few additional reasons. They were in an interracial marriage in the years before the Supreme Court struck down all the state anti-miscegenation laws. They were activists in the civil rights movement. They were, you know, gainfully employed. Barney worked at the post office. Betty was a social worker. And they were active volunteers in their local Unitarian congregation, the historic South Church in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, founded in 1714. They called what they saw a flying saucer, a term that was widely used at the time. There had been significant waves of people reporting seeing flying saucers in 1947, in 1952, and in 1957, including both civilian and military pilots, in addition to people on the ground. This photo is from an alleged flying saucer seen over Passaic, New Jersey in 1952. Indeed, it is that same year, 1952, that the United States Air Force coined the term unidentified flying objects, or UFOs, because they wanted people to stop calling them flying saucers. Now, prior to their late-night experience in 61, the Hills were aware of and a bit ambivalent about flying saucers. They thought of themselves as respectable, rational Unitarians. After the incident, Betty even asked Barney, "Do you believe in flying saucers now?" And he replied, "Of course not." At the time, they were likely suffering, and I think they would say this later, suffering from a combination of shock, denial, or amnesia, all of which is pretty common in the wake of these incidents. The earliest version of their story is that, quote, "a strange light in the sky chased them down New Hampshire Route 3. Later, through hypnosis, they began to remember, quote, small human-like creatures who kidnapped them, took them aboard the light, which turned out to be a craft, and subjected them to experimentation." But even the next day, there's more to the story. They discovered that, very inexplicably, Barney's shoes were scuffed and Betty's dress was torn. And when Betty called her sister to describe this weird thing that had happened, she shared that, you know, there's also these strange spots that had appeared on her car. And I think because of some of the flying saucer lore that was going around, her sister said, "Hold a compass to them." And the needle began to spin madly, according to what they reported. This sketch Barney later made of what their abductors looked like. Now, today, if you drive down that road and look closely, you'll spot a historical marker that says this: on the night of September 19 to 20th, 1961, a Portsmouth, New Hampshire couple, Betty and Barney Hill, experienced a close encounter of an unidentified flying object in 2 hours of lost time while driving south on Route 3 near Lincoln. They filed an official Air Force Project Blue Book report of a brightly lit cigar-shaped craft the next day, but were not public with their story until it was leaked in the Boston Traveler in 1965. This was the first widely reported UFO abduction in the United States. So part of what's also interesting about their story is, like, they didn't already have all this kind of information that could, like, map onto. They were sort of the first kind of telling this narrative. Now, there's a lot more to the Hill's life story. I recommend Bowman's book if you're interested in learning more. But I don't want to get lost in the weeds of this one account, though I think it's an interesting entry point, especially for UUs. For a larger context, I think it's important to name that when we try to think about aliens and UFOs and UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, that's what the military is now trying to rebrand them as UAPs. I think there's a lot of background factors that shape our imagination. So as we seek to discern what's happening, it's important just to kind of name that we consciously and unconsciously bring to the table a lot of associations. Everything we've seen on Star Trek and Star Wars and E.T. and Predator and Alien and ALF. And ALF, anybody? All right, child of the 80s here. All right. The X-Files and more. Now, if I had to limit myself to one popular film that is perhaps most helpful for constructively shaping our imaginations, I recommend the film Arrival. Have any of you seen it? This is incredible. Like, if you've not seen Arrival, go home and watch it tonight if you can. It's based on an incredible short story by the writer Ted Chiang. Any Ted Chiang fans out there? He has two phenomenal books of short stories, and this is just a short story in one of them. I'm also a big film of The Fan Contact. Anybody remember that? It's quite a few years ago now. That's based on a novel by Carl Sagan. Fiction can be invaluable for opening our collective imaginations. As the Jodie Foster character says in this film, the universe is a pretty big place. It's bigger than anything anyone has ever dreamed of before. So if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space. Now, almost 500 years ago, Copernicus showed us that we humans are not the center of life, the universe, and everything, as we used to think, right? We used to think we were literally the center of everything. In our home solar system, our planet is merely the third rock from the sun. And the sun, around, if you'll see that little sun at the bottom, the sun around which our planet orbits is at the edge of a much vaster Milky Way galaxy. Our entire galaxy is only one of more, you know, Carl Sagan used to always say billions and billions, right? Well, it's even bigger than that. We now think there are more than 2 trillion galaxies, and not solar systems, galaxies, 2 trillion. Or maybe we're in a multiverse. But that's probably a sermon for another day. Any Spider-Verse fans out there? These movies are surprisingly good. Like, anyway, impressive. All right. But limiting ourselves to just this one universe, astronomers estimate that there are 1 sextillion, that's 1,000 trillion habitable planets. 1,000 trillion habitable planets out there. And that's also like our conception of what's habitable. That's, I don't want to get distracted on that. So again, if it's just us, seems like an awful waste of habitable planets. So, are there aliens, though, out there inhabiting those planets? Like Mulder from the X-Files, some of us are on the I want to believe side of the equation. Others, like Scully, are more skeptical. Any self-identified Mulders out there? I want to believe. All right. Scullies? Skeptics? All right. Somewhere in between? All right. Fair enough. From my perspective, the almost unfathomable vastness of the universe challenges us to practice what philosophers call, this is a little bit of a fancy word, epistemic humility. Epistemology is from the Greek word for knowledge. It's the branch of philosophy that studies how we humans know what we know, but also what the scope is of what it is possible for us to know as humans, given our human senses. Because, of course, we know there's all these other, you know, things that are outside what we can see and hear and, you know, beyond those bandwidths. So epistemic humility invites us to be appropriately honest and humble about the limitations of our finite human perspective, even as we also perpetually seek to expand the horizons of our knowledge. So on the one hand, we humans already know a lot. This image is one of the huge number of deep space images from the incredible new James Webb Space Telescope, right? I know so many people were just agog over those images, and the fact that we can, you know, do something even more advanced than Hubble and put it out in space, right? That's incredible. So we've come a long way since Copernicus in the 16th century, when Copernicus rocked the foundations of human knowledge with what we would consider today a toy telescope, right? He would love to get his hands on what you could buy for $100 online, right? That would have been incredible to him. On the other hand, we need to be honest about how much we don't know. Our challenge is not only to look backwards and celebrate how much more we know than Copernicus almost 500 years ago, but also to extrapolate forward to how future humans will likely look back on us the way we look back at Copernicus. To adapt a quote from the late Alan Hynek, one of the world's most most influential astronomers, he said, "There is a tendency in 21st century science to forget that there's going to be 22nd century science, and indeed a 30th century science from which vantage point our current knowledge of the universe may look quite different." The philosopher and psychologist William James made a similar point. He said that we humans may be in the universe as dogs and cats are in our libraries, hearing the conversation but having no inkling as to the meaning of it all. I mean, think about it from the cat's perspective. That cat thinks it knows what's up. But we humans know those books that it's sitting on and surrounded by contain knowledge that is orders of magnitude beyond what that cat has the capacity to grok. That perspective informs how I think about the spooky, the weird, the uncanny experiences that we humans sometimes have, including with aliens or UFOs or UAPs. Such experiences may sometimes be our encounters with phenomena that are orders of magnitude beyond which we humans, at least currently, have the capacity to grok. Or perhaps some UAPs are the equivalent of what to us would be 30th or 40th century or beyond technology from civilizations that got a head start of us. As the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke famously said, any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Each semester when I teach an undergraduate world religions course at Frederick Community College, we consider just these sort of religious and philosophic ideas in regard to aliens and UFOs and UAPs. We do a lot of other things, but we use this textbook titled Comparing Religions, The Study of What Changes Us. The Study of Us That Changes Us by Jeffrey Kripal, who's a professor of philosophy and religious thought at Rice University in Houston, Texas, who also happens to be one of my favorite religion scholars. And if my students don't remember anything else from the 12-week course, I suspect they remember Chapter 8. It's titled Angels, Aliens, and Art, The Imagination and the Paranormal. From a religious studies perspective, part of the pattern you start to notice is that all around the world and across time, people have described seeing anomalous light forms. They use the same basic descriptions to describe those anomalous life forms, but then they interpret the meaning of what those light forms are through radically different cultural lenses. If you bracket the historical context and focus on the phenomenological language that people use to describe what they're seeing, suddenly you notice very similar language was actually used in the Middle Ages to describe fairies, and by Roman Catholics to describe apparitions they sometimes thought were the Virgin Mary, especially if you look at the descriptions of the apparitions in Fatima, Portugal, and by more contemporary folks to describe UFOs. As the author of the textbook says, sometimes comparison just gets you into trouble. Now, there's a lot more to say about that comparative perspective, but our focus today is on aliens and UFOs and UAPs, so we'll keep our focus there. We started with in 1961 with the abduction of Betty and Barney Hill, but I want to fast forward now 30 years to 1987 when Whitley Strieber published his best-selling book, Communion. How many of you remember when this book came out? This is like a big deal. Strieber received a 250,000 letters in response to individuals all over the world who recognized either the iconic so-called grays on the cover or traces of their own spiritually traumatic experiences of alien abduction in his descriptions of his own experiences. In the words of one of these experiencers, quote, "To say it was aliens is to assume a lot, but to say what happened to me is weird is to understate it. It was extraordinarily weird. And although it is not possible to do science in some kind of double-blind, replicable in laboratory conditions study with such a single anomalous experience," this experiencer says, "I don't deny what happened to me. It happened." Have any of you read Communion? All right, a few hands out there. If you're curious about that book, I'd say arguably a better place to start today is his much more recent book, this co-authored with Jeffrey Kripal, who I mentioned earlier. It's titled The Supernatural, A New Vision of the Unexplained. Another classic entry point is a book titled Abduction, Human Encounters with Aliens by the late John Mack. Now, it's really significant who John Mack was. He served as the head of the Department of Psychiatry at Harvard Medical School for almost 30 years. He also won a Pulitzer Prize for his book titled A Prince of Our Disorder about T.E. Lawrence. He brought that considerable experience and credentials to bear on investigating more than 60 cases of alien abduction. His conclusions echo the perspective of epistemic humility that we've been tracing. In Mack's words, the UFO phenomena is a window into a universe that is far more complicated, far more interesting, far more challenging, and far more awe-inspiring than anything we have previously imagined. To add another major voice to the investigation, Jacques Vallée is another highly credentialed scientist. He co-developed the first computerized map of Mars for NASA in 1963. He was also the inspiration for the French scientist character some of you may remember in Steven Spielberg's film, Close Encounters of the Third Kind. After extensive research, part of Vallée's conclusion is that we are dealing with something that is both technological and psychic. Somehow both kind of subjective and objective, both mental and physical, and seems to be able to manipulate other dimensions. This is neither wishful thinking nor personal speculation on my part. It is the conclusion that comes from interviewing critical witnesses and then listening to what they have to say. I don't have time, again, to fully unpack that quote from Vallée, but if you're kind of thinking, like, okay, what does that exactly mean, mental and physical, psychic and technological, this book by Jeffrey Kripal, The Flip, Epiphanies of Mind and the Future of Knowledge, is the best kind of short, accessible introduction I've found to that kind of perspective that Vallée is developing and coming from. I also bring up Kripal because his impressive level of scholarship for many decades now in this controversial area of study, he helped convince Rice University, that prestigious private research university in Houston, Texas, to open what they are calling the Archives of the Impossible, to actually gather what data they can on whatever is going on. They've collected the papers of all the major figures we've been exploring so far, Jacques Vallée, Whitley Strieber, John Mack, as well as papers from a growing number of other leading investigators into whatever is happening around aliens and UFOs and UAPs. You can learn more, just go to impossiblearchives.rice.edu, or if you just Google Archives of the Impossible, it'll pop right up. A turning point in my own view came in 2017. I wonder how many of you remember this headline in the New York Times? Like, okay, I see a few hands, my regular Times readers. One of the oldest and most widely respected newspapers in the world published this bombshell article, Two Navy Airmen and an Object That Accelerated Like Nothing I've Ever Seen. It's about a 2004 video released by the United States Defense Department that shows two Navy F-18s encountering an unknown object. One of the pilots on the recording says, quote, "Again, it's accelerated like nothing I've ever seen. It had no plumes, no wings, no rotors, and it outran our F-18s." You can watch them track the object for about a minute, and then you see it rapidly accelerate off to the left. You can watch the video for yourself on the New York Times website. Similar articles have appeared in the Washington Post. A good place to start is this article from 2021 titled, "Report Does Not Confirm or Rule Out Extraterrestrial Activity in Unexplained Aerial Events." Again, I think what's most interesting are the videos. Here is a screenshot of that video that was released in 2017 of U.S. fighter jets, again, tracking a UAP. I'll conclude for now with two final resources if you're curious to go deeper. First, if you really want to get into it, there's an app for that. Anybody got CE5 on their... Okay, I see a few. Got this on your iPhone. Dr. Stephen Greer has developed a protocol that if you want to increase your likelihood of having an extraterrestrial experience, which you may or may not want to do, given the sometimes some people really want to do this, and there are ways to do it that are better and worse, so read more in the app. But it can be traumatic for experiencers. Proceed with caution, is what I will say. Greer calls this sort of human-initiated experience a CE5, a close encounter of the fifth kind. There's this whole like gradient of types of close encounters. Second, if you're into podcasts, the philosopher and musician Stuart Davis has a very intriguing podcast called Aliens and Artists about the intersection between these experiences and human creativity, and he interviews experiencers if you want to learn more about all of this. I'll conclude for now with a quote from the philosopher J.S. Haldane that often comes to mind when I reflect on experiences around, again, aliens or UFOs or UAPs. Haldane said, "My own suspicion is that the universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it's actually queerer than we humans can suppose. I suspect," he says, "that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamed of or can be dreamed of in any human philosophy. It's a wild, vast universe out there, and if it's just us, it seems like an awful waste of space." For now, as we continue to ponder our place as earthlings in the grand scheme of things, let's rise in body or spirit. Let's sing together hymn 1064, Blue Boat Home.
Two quick final things. The first, logistical. If you're interested in the Ask Me Anything, be back here in the sanctuary. We're going to start right at noon online. We're going to close this Zoom room, but then you can log back in a little bit before noon and if you want to join us online. The final point is just one final analogy that I think is helpful for thinking about this whole area of aliens and UFOs and UAPs. Did any of you know the sort of classic novella? It was written in 1884 by Edwin Abbott, titled Flatland. Okay, good. Got some Flatland. It's interestingly technical, actually, if you go back and read it. But the gist of it is, that I think matters for us, it's a dialogue between an inhabitant of Flatland and an inhabitant of Spaceland. Flatland, if this doesn't traumatize anybody back to algebra, is, do you remember the X and Y axis, the coordinate plane? So you graph stuff, you know, either vertically on this plane. So that's Flatland. It's imagine a completely two-dimensional world that's only a Flatland. And they're in dialogue with someone in Spaceland that's trying to get someone who only knows two dimensions, an X and Y axis, to understand a Z axis that creates three dimensions. And so imagine this. This is the last piece I'll say. There's more to the story. But if you imagine if you're in Flatland and imagine a three-dimensional sphere pass through Flatland through a coordinate plane, that sphere, you would see these increasing planes of it, right? So it would start as like a dot in the sky and then this growing disk. It would never be a sphere, right? But as that sphere, as it thicker and thicker, passed through, you'd see this growing and growing circle. And then once it got past the midpoint, it would be a decreasingly small disk until it became a dot. So that people in Flatland would spend all this time hypothesizing about this dot that became a disk, that all while being unable to have the capacity to grok a sphere. And so in turn, something, again, like that may be happening with what's going on with UAPs or UFOs, that this, like, one order of magnitude beyond what we humans typically have the capacity to grok. So as we go into the rest of this day and into the week to come, I do think when spooky, weird stuff happens to us, we are again called to say, how do I still continue my journey with love, right? And I think that's a real takeaway if you watch that movie Arrival, is it's trying to do a flip on the War of the Worlds, right? That this, how do we not necessarily interpret things militaristically and antagonistically? How do we continue our journey with love? How do we care for one another? This is another takeaway of Arrival. How do we care for this one Earth? That's one of the most consistent thing experiencers come back with is we're getting this message that we're messing this Earth up. We need to care for this one Earth. We need to do justice and to make peace. And as we go, whatever taste or touch we've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace or joy, that goes with you into the world. We are different for having spent this time together. May you live boldly. May you live with thanksgiving.